it's just like something just came in and plowed its way through Kotlik. It was really bad.
A large storm floods communities in western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a veteran who turned her childhood dream into a reality.
She says, why are you doing this? And I said, because this is what I'm supposed to be. And I says, I'm going to be a full colonel squadron commander in Alaska. And guess what? That's what I was.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A storm that brought high winds, high water, and high surf caused flooding to communities along the coast of western Alaska this weekend. At least two communities have made disaster declarations. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the report.
Due to the storm Saturday night that went on into Sunday morning, the communities of Kotlik and Unalakleet each declared a disaster. Strong winds and high water caused flooding in both communities, along with the community of Stebbins. Jimmy O'Kitgun is the pastor at the Assembly of God Church in Kotlik. He says the community was flooded early Sunday morning at about midnight, and shortly after, ice moved in, causing extensive damage to the water and sewer lines. Half of the community is without water and sewer.
It's just like something just came in and plowed its way through Kotlik. It was just ice coming in, so it was really bad. And there's places that have 4 feet of ice, and boats are everywhere, pushed further up on the banks.
O'Kitgun says there are a few houses that have water and ice damage. People late Saturday night were evacuated to the school and to homes that sit on higher ground. With the extensive water and sewer damage to half the homes in Kotlik, some families are still staying at the school.
There's a lot of damage and utility doors broken in half, bent out of shape, houses, and pipes torn from the houses.
O'Kitgun says storms have gotten worse in recent years. In 2011, Kotlik, like other coastal communities, was hit by a November storm, and the storm this weekend was the worst he's seen in recent years.
This one was stronger. The water came in faster and stronger, and then when the ice followed, it got even worse.
The city of Kotlik was in communication yesterday with the state of Alaska. They held a community meeting this afternoon to talk about what needs to take place to make repairs. And in Stebbins, at around 6:30 Saturday night, police and volunteers began loading people into vehicles in a community-wide evacuation. Francis Pete Sr., evacuation team volunteer, said it was the worst flooding Stebbins has seen in decades.
We had water coming in both ways, and it came up quick, worse than the last floods we had. Me and my friends, relatives, we remember 1964, that was the last time we had flood like this. But some elders say that it was worse than 1964.
Pete said the flooding moved 3 to 4 homes off their foundations, drifted boats, damaged fish racks and smokehouses, and relocated a water pipe. However, Pete does say the shifted pipe does not affect the community's water supply. And up the coast, the Unalakleet City Council declared a disaster this morning. Waves in Unalakleet early Sunday morning were up to 12 to 14 feet. 10 homes were evacuated, and there was some property damage to individual homes. And communities, while cleaning and making repairs, are also preparing for a storm that's expected to hit Tuesday evening. The National Weather Service reports that a storm will bring heavy surf and the possibility of more coastal flooding on Wednesday night and into Thursday. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
Alaska's Filipino community is pulling together to help the victims of Super Typhoon Haiyan, which hit the country early Friday morning. Tens of thousands are feared dead and injured from the storm, one of the most powerful ever recorded. According to news reports, 10,000 people are believed to have died in Tacloban City. The storm knocked out power and communications to much of the central Philippines. Dante Reyes is president of Juno's nonprofit Filipino Community Incorporated. He's from Atlan Province, where close to 10,000 homes were destroyed.
So we're still waiting for some reports coming in from our relatives and from some of our friends, what happened to them, or are they okay or fine or something like that. And so it's really hard.
Filipino Community Incorporated held a membership meeting on Saturday where Reyes says they decided to cancel the organization's free Thanksgiving Day meal. Instead, the group will donate the $3,000 budgeted for the event to relief efforts. In addition, there will be a fundraising dinner on Saturday, November 23rd at the Filipino Community Hall in downtown Juneau.
We will be having the traditional American and Filipino dishes. So we will have turkey for sure. We will have the Filipino kind of beef steak. We call it bistik. So we're planning to have a community-wide fundraiser for the event, and hopefully we could raise money to help the victims of the typhoon.
The Filipino community of Anchorage is working to figure out what shape their relief effort will take. President Leticia Tadina says she is talking with airlines and other companies to get a discounted shipping rate to send supplies to her home country, especially tents and sleeping bags. She says people need the basics.
They're hungry for food, water, clothing, shelter, all the prime commodities. There are nothing. They were left behind with zero.
Tadina says her organization will also raise funds to send to the Philippines. She says the group is meeting Saturday to work out the details. After months of negotiations, KTUU-TV and GCI were unable to reach an agreement by their midnight deadline on Friday to keep KTUU's programming available on cable in the more rural areas of the state. KTUU spokesman Brad Hilwig says the two parties came close on financial terms, but it was primarily non-monetary terms that kept an agreement from being reached.
They dealt with issues such as exclusivity of NBC in not non-Anchorage or rural areas. GCI sought assurances that KTUU would not challenge any attempts on their part to put another NBC signal in rural Alaska.
Hilwig says another sticking point included a potential tiering system in the future that might allow cable companies to make subscribers buy access to local channels. GCI Vice President David Morris says another roadblock involved KTUU's desire for additional channel capacity, but he says negotiations between the two parties are not over.
This is just one part of a very complex contractual arrangement between Schurz Communication and GCI. Negotiations will continue, and we remain open that if Channel 2 comes back with a serious offer, we can come to some type of agreement about rural Alaska.
Alaska Rural Communications Services, or ARCS, will still carry some KTUU programming, including news and late-night programs like Saturday Night Live. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fire truck delivery to a remote community that took nearly a year.
Since that time, of course, we've tried everything that we could to find a way to get it to St. George.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and north slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The administrative fee for vaccines through the state's public health system is being waived in an effort to get more low-income people protected from flu this season. Rhonda Richmeyer is the chief of public health nursing for the state. She says the free vaccines are being offered because there's already been a number of hospitalizations from flu this year.
We're concerned. We don't know for sure yet, but we are concerned that this may be an earlier and more severe flu season. And because of that, we really want to make sure that we're making it as easy as possible for all Alaskans to get their flu vaccine.
Richmeyer says the free vaccines will be available at any public health center around the state to anyone eligible for state-purchased vaccine. That's anyone under the age of 3 or anyone older than 3 who does not have health insurance or insurance that covers vaccines. The free vaccines will be offered until the end of December. It takes 10 days after the shot to get full protection from the flu. A big blue fire truck is on its way from Unalaska to the Pribilof Island of St. George. The truck has been ready to go for almost a year, but until now, the two communities had no way to move it. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, they found their solution in a crab boat.
The truck is being lifted off the Trident Seafoods dock by a crane and lowered onto the deck of the Far West Leader. This fishing boat just offloaded their last haul of king crab, and now...
Put a fire truck on a boat. A 109-foot crab boat.
St. George has been trying to get the aging fire truck, known as Big Blue, to their island since May 2012. That's when they bought Big Blue from the Sitka Fire Department for a dollar. They'd been without a working fire truck for 2 years. St. George's Mayor Pat Pletnikoff says they tried every option they could find. Big Blue was too big to travel on any ferry, so the town arranged to have it flown out by the Air National Guard during a training exercise. But the exercise was canceled. In the meantime, Pletnikoff says the need for a new fire truck became clearer than ever.
Our carpenter shop that was owned by our village corporation burnt down. Ironically, that's probably 200-300 feet from our public safety building on St. George. And had we had a fire truck that we could connect and get water to it, we might have been able to do something about the fire.
Almost a year ago, the state paid for a barge to move the fire truck. It was too big to fit in St. George's Harbor, so instead they dropped the truck off in Unalaska.
And since that time, of course, we've tried everything that we could to find a way to get it to St. George.
In the end, Trident Seafoods donated the use of the vessels the town needed for the final push, a freighter with a crane that can handle a 10-ton fire truck, and a crab boat that can safely navigate St. George's shallow harbor. Once the crew of the Far West Leader chained the truck down on their deck, they got some basic instructions to pass along to St. George. Senior Fire Captain Zach Chastine has been taking care of the truck recently, and he tells deckhand Kyle Craig how to turn it on.
I don't know how familiar they are with the engine,
okay. But
just remember...
Turn that on.
They run through all the horns and switches, plus the most important piece of equipment.
The siren. Just turn that all the way up.
The fire truck is on its way to St. George, but even now there are still a few kinks in the plan. There wasn't a crane in St. George to get the truck off the crab boat until last month. Mayor Pletnikoff says one was just shipped in for another project.
So we have the equipment. But the individual that was operating the equipment injured himself and had to go back to Anchorage. And so, you know, that left us with someone who's operating the crane but doesn't have the kind of experience that I am totally, totally comfortable with but can do the job.
Another option would be to send the Far West Leader over to St. Paul first to pick up a trained crane operator. Either way, Pletnikoff says they'll find a way to get the truck off the boat.
I like to look at all the options and look at all the possibilities. And if I can do something that's going to be a little bit more convenient for the overall project, I'm going to do that.
And once it's done, he says the town is going to welcome their truck in style. They're planning a parade in its honor. And he says they're going to paint the town's name and official emblem, a fur seal, on Big Blue's side. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Over the weekend, Alaskans had their last chance to say goodbye to the state's Olympians and prospective Olympians before they start their seasons and eventually head to Sochi, Russia for the 2014 Olympic Games. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
A light layer of snow covered the ground, fitting for the occasion, as Alaska's Olympians and Olympic hopefuls strolled into Anchorage's town square to the cheers of supporters gathered to give the athletes an enthusiastic send-off. Nordic skier Holly Brooks, who competed in the 2010 Games in Vancouver, says, despite Alaska being so large and its population so spread out, it still manages to remain a very close-knit community.
Alaskans really get behind their Olympians and their athletes, and that we really feel a lot of support from the community, so it's pretty special.
Keegan Randall, who will be competing in her fourth Olympic Games, says events where community members get a chance to chat with their Olympians are important, because when she was younger, those events inspired her Olympic dreams.
I mean, I remember when Tommy Moe won the gold medal in Lillehammer and came back and signed posters at the Alaska Club. I remember when Nina Kempel was out and signed a poster for me when I was 10 years old at the Gold Nugget Triathlon.
Since then, Randall has become a source of inspiration for Alaska's next generation of Olympians. Along the way, she's earned the support of the community, and she says that means a lot.
There's no doubt in my mind that so many people in this community have helped me get to where I am today. So to really just be able to celebrate that one more time and capture all this great energy so that we can take it with us on the road.
Both Brooks and Randall leave later this week for Europe and the World Cup circuit, which starts in about 2 weeks. Randall says it will be an extremely hectic schedule from now through the end of the Olympics.
We race the World Cup up until 4 days before the opening ceremonies. So we literally go to Munich, pack away our U.S. ski team stuff, grab our Olympic stuff, and head over to Sochi, and then we just hit the ground running once we're there.
The 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia start on February 7th and continue through February 23rd. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Cross-country skiing isn't the only sport Alaskans targeting the Sochi Winter Olympics compete in. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a Fairbanks man is vying for a spot on the U.S. speed skating team.
Liam Ortega's Olympic dream was shattered in 2008 when he was bowled over by another skater in practice and cracked his skull on the ice. He survived a coma and worked his way back to competing, but not soon enough to make the 2010 Winter Games in Vancouver. Now, 4 years later, he credits skating with his return to full health.
The drive and the love of skating is how I recovered from my traumatic brain injury.
The 29-year-old Ortega grew up cross-country skiing and playing hockey in Fairbanks and only picked up speed skating through a now-defunct local club. He was good at it and focused in while attending college in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, home of one of just two full-size speed skating ovals in the U.S. He's been back there in recent months pursuing his Olympic dream.
Going to do my very best to perhaps be the first Alaskan speed skating Olympian.
Ortega fell short of making the fall World Cup team, but remains focused on next month's Olympic trials in Salt Lake City, Utah. He says he plans to spend December there living at altitude to prepare for his target events.
The way my body's shaping up is I'll be most competitive in the 5 and 10K, and you need to have that aerobic adaptation to be successful on those distance races.
Ortega says the times he needs to skate at Olympic trials require what he calls suicide pace.
A pace that makes you nervous after 4 laps in with 12 total, to where like you start to feel a little bit of a burn, and then maybe around lap 7 or 8, you just get into that tunnel vision towards like the turn that you're in is the only turn that matters. You can't look ahead to the next turn. You can't even look ahead to the end of the turn. You're just so focused on that moment.
Ortega, who's worn a helmet in training since the accident, still races without one. He says helmets aren't required in races, and wearing one would slow him down too much. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
Many of us will be watching ceremonies or attending celebrations this Veterans Day, but as APRN's Dave Waldron reports, one Alaskan has dedicated her retirement to honoring our state's military.
Colonel Sue Ellen Novak has an impressive military resume. She was the first female ever commissioned through her local ROTC chapter, and she was just the fifth female lab officer in the history of the United States Air Force. She's had every job from medical squadron commander to head of the Air Force blood program. Today, she's retired, but she still keeps very busy running the Alaska Veterans Museum in Anchorage.
You need to come up and see us. We're right behind the Eskimo Scout statue on 4th Avenue. We're at the corner of 4th Avenue and Diaz and Delta Street. And we can tell you some really great stories. It's a fun time. It's the best $3 you've ever spent.
Novak has been in charge of the museum since it launched in 2011, but her military service started much further back.
Well, I did over 32 plus years in the United States Air Force. I was truly blessed because it was all I ever wanted to do or be.
And that is not an understatement. Novak recalls when her third grade teacher asked the students in her class to draw what they wanted to be when they grew up.
So I'm sketching away and she's standing over looking at me and she goes, well, and what is this? And I says, I'm a second lieutenant. I'm going to the Air Force. And I says, I'm saluting a major outside of barracks. She says, your family isn't military. No, ma'am. She says, why are you doing this? And I says, because this is what I'm supposed to be. And I says, I'm going to be a full colonel squadron commander in Alaska. And guess what? That's what I was.
The Alaska Veterans Museum is packed with military memorabilia. Posters and photos line every inch of the wall. Massive models of warships sit in glass displays, and each corner of the room seems to have a story to tell. Novak points out the display of the USS Grunion.
That's my favorite of all time. That one is a case of the submarine was lost on July the 30th, 1942. She was last heard from. And she wasn't found until 2007 due to the love of the skipper's three sons trying to find out what happened to their dad. And so they actually did locate where the Grunion was. They took pictures and we tell that story back here.
And there's some oral history as well, including interviews from the final four Alaskan scouts, the last of whom passed away just this year.
Then how did you come to join the Alaska Scouts?
Well, I was stationed at Adak Island with outpost.
Another gem in the museum is a dress made entirely out of a parachute. It belonged to an Alaskan military wife and has quite the story.
Ronelda Ronvelda Peacock. Her husband was a B-17 driver in World War II. He was asked to volunteer for a mission. He got shot down on that mission. When he got shot down, he had to hit the silk. He had to parachute out.
The soldier went down over Russia and was even held captive by the Russians despite being an ally of the U.S. at the time. After his release, the soldier had no choice but to sell the only thing he had left for food and supplies, his parachute. But he only sold half.
He kept this other half of the parachute, and when he got back to his base at Foggia, Italy, he took it down to the seamstress. And he said, okay, he says, this is what I want done. Here's my wife's measurements. I want a robe and nightie made out of this. And oh, by the way, those two bullet holes that are in the front, keep those in the front, right up in plain sight, because I don't want her to ever forget what I went through to get this for.
And Novak says that's what the museum is all about, remembering our veterans. She hopes these heroes will be on everyone's mind this Veterans Day.
Anchorage is very good at saying thank you to its veterans. But as fewer and fewer people serve in the military, and now it's less than 1% of the population has any military experience whatsoever, it's more and more important that we remember those people.
For APRN, I'm Dave Waldron.
It's easy to let Veterans Day pass without thinking about the holiday's meaning, but Vietnam vet and retiring pilot Rex Gray has been reflecting on what the day means to him.
The gate agent announced to the passengers awaiting to board it was my last flight through Fairbanks. While reviewing the flight paperwork, a gentleman approached, wanting to shake my hand and wish me well in the upcoming retirement. He was short, tan, and fit-looking. Across the front of his baseball cap, it said, World War II vet. He was 94. We chatted. He flew a B-17 bomber in Italy during the war. I quickly did the math. That would have made him 23 or 24. He would have been an old man on the airplane. This summer, I've been sharing war stories about those young flight crews serving in Europe and the sacrifices they made. I've been volunteering as a pilot docent on Aluminum Overcast, the Experimental Aircrafts Association B-17, a four-engine bomber known as a Flying Fortress. I had the honor of talking with some of the surviving crew members. They may move a bit slower, haven't met a one without a hearing aid, but they all remember the missions, the excitement, the fear, the O-300 briefs, the bad eggs at breakfast, and the plane that brought them home safely. Now, some 70 years later, We refer to those that served in World War II as the greatest generation. They were. Why did it take us so long to realize that? Today's military personnel, we haven't labeled them yet. They're just young men and women doing a job. The equipment has changed. Now it's Blackhawks, C-17s, F-22s, and a variety of other sophisticated military equipment. Our Alaskan soldiers are out there protecting our freedoms and striving to gain freedoms for others less fortunate. Some wear the uniform daily, and others serve as guardsmen or citizen soldiers. They leave loved ones behind and deploy to Afghanistan. Family members left behind sacrifice. Alone, they cope with a daily crisis, be it a simple flat tire or a devastating car wreck. Parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and other extended family members are doing whatever they can to encourage and support. During deployment, the nightly news is cautiously watched. The threats today may be different than the B-17 the crews experienced, but the potential outcome is the same. Losing body parts from German flak or by driving across an IED in Afghanistan has the same result, a changed life. It's not only an enemy threat, but dare I say it, our own military too. Non-combat losses in the B-17 were as bad as the combat losses. Mid-airs, training accidents, equipment failures, and weather all contributed significantly. We may have the best military in the world, but our troops today still have to deal with training mistakes, bad equipment, and sometimes less than stellar political military decisions. Yet they are still willing to serve and protect. Names and faces of those Alaskans I have known who paid with the ultimate sacrifice are popping into my head. Remembering is good, but I wish I didn't have to. I wish they were still here getting old enough to someday earn their own respectful generation nickname. So when you see them, the greatest generation, or those now serving, stop. Take a moment. Say thanks. When you see the families, parents, grandparents at Costco, stop. Say thanks. It doesn't have to be Veterans Day, and they don't have to be gray-haired vets.
Rex Gray is a Vietnam veteran and a retiring commercial pilot. Today is his last day flying with Alaska Airlines. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alex Hotel and Suites, featuring amenities that include a 24-hour airport shuttle, hot continental breakfast, and a walk-in freezer. Information on Alaska resident rates at 1-800-221-7550. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.